Chapter 15. "What the hell do we do now?" Claudia said from the top of the stairs.
"Call the police," I said from the bottom.
"How?"
"I'll take the car and find somewhere with a signal," I said. But there was no way Claudia and my mother were allowing me to go off in the car, leaving them alone in the house with the gunman. Dead or not, they were still very frightened of him, and I can't say I blame them. "Pack up our things," I said to Claudia. "Mum, pack an overnight bag. No, take enough for a few days. We're going somewhere else."
"But why?" my mother asked.
"Because someone sent this man here to kill me. And when they find out that he hasn't succeeded, that someone might send another to try again." Neither of them asked the obvious question. Why was the man trying to kill me? Instead, they both quickly went together to pack, taking the torch with them and leaving me standing in the dark. In spite of being pretty certain the man was indeed dead, I didn't stop listening, holding the gun ready in case he made a miraculous recovery. I found I was shaking. I took several deep breaths, but the shaking continued. Perhaps it was from fear or relief, or maybe it was a reaction to the sudden realization that I had killed a man, probably a bit of all three. The shaking continued for several minutes, and I became totally exhausted by it. I wanted to sit down, and I felt slightly sick.
"We're packed," Claudia said from upstairs, the torchlight again shining down the stairway.
"Good," I said. "Pass the things down to me."
I stepped carefully onto the first few stairs next to the man's legs and reached up as Claudia handed down our bags and my mother's suitcase. Next, I guided each of them down in turn, making sure they stepped only on the wood and not on the man.
Oh my God," Claudia said, repeating it over and over again, as she came nervously down the stairs, pressing herself against the side while, at the same time, holding her hands up to ensure she wouldn't touch the man by mistake. My mother was surprisingly much more stoical, waltzing down the stairs as if there was nothing there. In fact, I suspected that she would have liked to have given the corpse a sharp kick for ruining her roast dinner.
The three of us went out to the car, loaded the stuff, and drove away down the rutted lane, leaving the dead man alone in the dark house. I drove into Cheltenham and called the police, but I didn't dial the emergency number. Instead, I called Chief Inspector Tomlinson on his mobile.
"The man who killed Herb Kovac," I said, "is lying dead at the bottom of my mother's stairway."
There was the slightest of pauses.
"How tiresome of him," the chief inspector said. "Did he just lie down there and die?"
"No," I said. "He broke his neck falling down the stairs."
"Was he pushed?"
he asked once again, demonstrating his suspicious mind.
"Helped," I said. "We fell down the stairs together. He came off worse, but he was trying to stab me with a carving knife at the time."
"What happened to his gun?"
he asked.
"He lost it under the fridge," I said.
"Hmm," he said. "And have you told the local constabulary?"
"No," I said. "I thought you could do that. And you can also tell them he was a foreigner."
"How do you know?"
"He said something I didn't understand."
"And where are you now?" he asked.
"In Cheltenham," I said. "The gunman cut the power and the telephone wires. I've had to leave to make a call on my mobile. There's no signal at the cottage."
"Is anyone still at the cottage?"
"Only the dead man," I said. "I have Claudia and my mother with me in the car."
"So are you going back there now?" he asked.
"No," I said firmly. "Whoever sent this man could send another."
"So where are you going?" he asked, not questioning my decision.
"I don't know yet," I said. "I'll call you when I do."
"Who knew you were at your mother's place?" he asked. "Always the detective."
"Everyone in my office," I said. "And whomever else Mrs. McDowd had told," I thought.
"Right," he said. "I'll call the Gloucestershire police, but they'll definitely want to talk to you. And to Claudia, and your mother. They may even want you back at the cottage."
"Tell them I'll call them there in 2 hours," I said.
"But you said the line had been cut." "Then get it fixed," I said. "And get the power back on. Tell them I think my mother has left the stove on. I don't want the place burning down when the power's reconnected. And also tell them I've left the back door unlocked so they won't have to break the front door down to get in."
"Okay," he said. "I'll tell them." He paused.
"Is the gun still under the fridge?"
"No," I said. "I retrieved it."
"So where is it now?"
I had so wanted to bring it with me, to give myself the armed protection that I'd been denied by the police.
"It's outside the front door," I said. "In a bush."
"Right," he said, sounding slightly relieved. "I'll tell the Gloucestershire force that too. Save them hunting for it, and you."
"Good," I said.
It had been the right decision to leave the gun behind. I could still claim the moral high ground. I hung up and switched off my phone. I would call the police on my terms, and I also didn't want anyone being able to track my movements from the phone signal.
"Do you really think we're still in danger?" Claudia asked from next to me. I don't know, I said, but I'm not taking any chances.
Who knew we were there? She asked.
Everyone at the office, I expect, I said. Mrs. McDowd definitely knew, and she'd have told everyone else.
And Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson has known as well.
I'd told him myself. It was my mother who finally asked the big question.
Why was that man trying to kill you? She said calmly from the back seat.
We were on the road between Cirencester and Swindon. I'd made one more stop in Cheltenham at one of the few remaining public phone boxes. I hadn't wanted to use my mobile for fear that someone could trace who I was calling. We were going where no one would find us. I'm not totally sure, but it may be because I'm a witness to him killing a man at Aintree Races, I said. And it wasn't the first time he'd tried. Neither my mother nor Claudia said anything. They were waiting for me to go on.
He was waiting outside our house in Lichfield Grove when I got back there on Tuesday afternoon, I said. Luckily, I could run faster than him.
Is that why we came to Woodmancote, Claudia asked, instead of going home?
It sure is, I said, but I didn't realise that Woodmancote wasn't safe either, not until it was too late. I won't make that mistake again.
But what about the police, my mother asked. Surely we must go to the police. They will look after us. But how much did I trust the police? I didn't know that either. They hadn't given me any protection when I'd asked for it, and that omission had almost cost us our lives. No, I thought, I trust my own instincts. The police seemed more interested in solving murders than preventing them.
I have been to the police, I said, driving on through the darkness, but it will be me who will look after you. And I would also find out who is trying to have me killed, and the real reason why.
Well, lover boy, Jan Setter said. When I asked you to come and stay, I didn't exactly mean you to bring your girlfriend and your mother with you.
We laughed. We were sitting at her kitchen table in Lambourne drinking coffee, the said girlfriend and mother having been safely tucked up in two of Jan's many spare bedrooms.
I didn't know where else to go, I said to her.
I had briefly thought about going to my father's bungalow in Weymouth, but he had only two double bedrooms, and amusing as the thought had been, I could hardly expect my parents to share a bed, not after 7 years of divorce, and I certainly wasn't sleeping with the old bugger.
So what's all this about? Jan asked finally.
All I had said to her on the phone from Cheltenham had been that I was desperate, and could she help by putting us up for a night or two?
How desperate? She had asked calmly.
Life or death, I'd said. Complete secrecy. She had asked nothing further, but had simply said, come. And she'd asked no questions when we'd arrived, not until after my traumatized mother and fiancé had been safely ushered up to bed. As it had with me, the shock and fear had manifested itself in them after the event. In all the years I had known Jan, both as her former jockey and more recently as her financial adviser, I had never known her to be flustered or panicked by anything. She was the steady head I needed in this crisis. But how much did I tell her? Would she even believe me?
I know this is going to sound rather overly dramatic, I said, but someone is trying to kill me.
What's her name? Jan asked with a laugh.
I'm being serious, Jan, I said. Tonight, a man came to my mother's cottage to murder me. He had a gun. I promise you, we are extremely fortunate to be alive. The same man has now tried to kill me twice.
Let's hope it isn't third time lucky.
He won't get a third time. How can you be sure? She asked. Because he's dead.
The last time I saw him, he was lying on the floor of my mother's sitting room with his neck broken.
She stared at me. You are being serious, aren't you? I nodded.
Very.
Have you called the police?
Yes, I said, but I need to call them again.
I looked at my watch. It had been at least 2 hours since I'd spoken to Chief Inspector Tomlinson, but they could wait a little longer.
So why come here, she asked. Why not go straight to the police?
I need somewhere to hide where no one can find me. Not even the police, I thought.
But if the man's dead, why do you still need to hide? She asked.
Because he was a hired killer, and I am worried that whoever hired him will simply hire another.
I could tell from the look on Jan's face that her credulity had reached its limit.
It's true, I assure you, I said. I'm not making it up. And I think it's all to do with stealing €100 million from the European Union. Now, that really is big money. And what's the going rate for having someone killed these days? 20,000? 100 grand maybe? Or even 500,000? That's still only half of 1% of the take, cheap at twice the price.
But what have you got to do with stealing €100 million? She asked.
Nothing, I said.
but I may have asked the wrong question to those that have, and I suspect that somebody believes I need to be permanently removed before I ask some more questions and bring the whole scheme tumbling down round their ears.
So what are you going to do? She said.
Ask the questions quickly, I said, grinning at her, and then keep my head down. Someone answered after just one ring when I called my mother's cottage. I was sitting in Jan's office and using her mobile phone, and I had carefully withheld the number from caller ID. I hoped it was enough to keep it secret.
Hello, I said. Is that Nicholas Foxton? Came a man's voice in reply.
It is, I said. To whom am I talking?
Detective Chief Inspector of Flight, he said. Gloucestershire Police.
Not another Detective Chief Inspector, I thought. What's the collective noun for Detective Chief Inspectors? It was a posse of police, so maybe it's an evidence of Detective Chief Inspectors.
Where are you, Mr. Foxton? Asked this particular Chief Inspector.
Somewhere safe, I said.
And where is that? He asked again.
I ignored him. Who is the man who tried to kill me? I asked.
Mr. Foxton, he said. I need you to come to a police station to be interviewed. Tonight.
He was persistent, I give him that.
Have you spoken to DCI Tomlinson from Merseyside Police? I asked. Or Superintendent Yearing from the Metropolitan Police Armed Response Team?
No, he said, not personally.
Then I suggest you do, I said.
Mr. Foxton, he said, you are in danger of obstructing the police in the course of their duties. Now please tell me where you are.
No, I said. Did you watch the television news on Tuesday? The dead man in my mother's cottage is the same man as in the video, and I think he was foreign. He said something I didn't understand, something like Ebby Say.
Mr. Foxton, Detective Chief Inspector Flight was getting quite worked up. I must insist you tell me where you are.
And I must insist you speak to DCI Tomlinson or Superintendent Yearing.
I hung up. That didn't go too well, I thought. Too bad. But I was definitely not going to any police station to be interviewed tonight, or any other night if I could help it. People could get shot at police stations. Ask Lee Harvey Oswald.
I heard Jan leave the house at 7:15 in the morning to supervise the exercising of her horses on the gallops. She had asked if I wanted to accompany her up onto the downs to watch, but I had declined, not because I didn't want to, but because I didn't want anyone to recognise me and hence know where I was staying. It may have been 8 years since I was a regular in Lambourne, but there were plenty who had been here longer than that, even amongst Jan's staff, and most would have known me by sight. I realised it was highly unlikely that news of my whereabouts would then get back to hostile ears, but I didn't want to take any unnecessary risks. I got up as quietly as I could, but Claudia was already awake.
Don't go, she said.
I snuggled down again next to her under the covers.
When will this all end? She asked.
Soon, I said. But I really had no idea when.
I was so frightened last night, she said with tears in her eyes. I really thought he was going to kill you.
I'd thought it too. But he didn't, I said, so everything's all right. I was trying to sound encouraging, even if I was not so sure inside.
So why have we come here? She asked. Why can't we go home now?
There's just a few things I have to do before we can go home, I said, sitting up on the side of the bed, and I don't want to take any chances if we don't need to.
I think we should go to the police, she said.
I spoke to them last night after you went to bed. They agreed that it was better for us to stay here for a couple of days while they carry out their investigations. At least the first bit was true.
So what is it that you have to do? She asked.
Well, first I have to go to Oxford, I said, and I'm going to do that right now. I stood up and started to dress.
I'll come with you, Claudia said, throwing the duvet to one side and sitting up.
No, I said firmly. You stay here with Jan and my mother. You need to recover fully from your operation, and I won't be long. You'll be quite safe here.
I think she was secretly relieved as she lay down again and pulled the duvet back over her.
Why are you going? She asked. To see a young man at the university, I said. I want to ask him some questions about a factory, or rather, about the lack of a factory.
I stopped on the outskirts of Oxford and turned on my mobile phone to call Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson.
DCI Flight of Gloucestershire Police is not happy with you, he said. Not happy at all.
Too bad, I said.
He's applied for a warrant for your arrest on suspicion of manslaughter.
But that's ridiculous, I said.
Maybe it is, he agreed, but he's really pissed off. I do think it might be better if you go and see him. Not if he's going to arrest me.
I didn't relish spending another day in a police cell. Anyway, I said, I have things to do first.
Not investigating again, are you? Said the professional detective. I've told you to leave that to the police.
But what are you going to investigate? I said. It is me, not you, that believes Colonel Jolyon Roberts was murdered, but there is no evidence for that belief. In fact, quite the reverse. The evidence indicates that he died of natural causes, helped by a dose of stupidity. The police see no crime, so there is no investigation.
So what do you want me to do?
He asked. Speak to Flight, I said. Get him off my back. Tell him there's no way I'll see him if he's going to arrest me.
I'll try, he said, but I still think you ought to at least talk to him.
Get me his number, I said. Then I'll call him.
How can I contact you?
Leave a message on this phone. I'll pick it up. Flight can do the same.
Anything else? He asked.
Yes, I said. Can you find out if the dead man in my mother's cottage was Bulgarian? I thought about also asking him to get the fraud squad to initiate an investigation into the Balscott factory project, but as I knew from previous experience with a former client, fraud investigations involving foreign investments started with months and months of delving into paperwork before there was any prospect of an arrest. Add to that the complexities of the European Union grant system, and it would take years. And I'd be dead and buried long before that. I disconnected from DCI Tomlinson, but the phone rang again in my hand almost immediately.
This is your voicemail, said an impersonal female voice when I answered. You have two new messages.
One of them was from DCI Flight, and as the other chief inspector had said, he didn't sound very happy. I ignored it. The other was from Patrick Lyle, who also wasn't pleased with me, in particular because I had left a message on his mobile saying that I wouldn't be coming into the office today.
Nicholas, Patrick's voice said, I'm sorry that you've decided not to be in the office once again. I think we need to have a talk about your commitment to the firm. I will be writing to you today, formally warning you as to your future conduct. Please would you call me and tell me where to have the letter delivered?
It sounded to me as if the company lawyer had been advising him again on employment law, written warnings and all that. I ignored him, too. Did I, in fact, have any future in the firm? And did I really care? Keble College was on the north side of the city, near the Oxford University Museum of Natural History. I parked in Museum Road and walked back to the college.
Sorry, sir,
said a man in a smart blue jersey, intercepting me in the entrance archway.
The college is closed to the public. Trinity has begun.
Trinity? I asked.
Trinity term, he says. The students are here.
It hadn't even crossed my mind they wouldn't be.
Exactly, I said to him. I've come to see one of the students.
Which one? He asked politely but firmly. He was obviously used to repelling visitors who had no good cause to be there.
Benjamin Roberts, I said.
And is Mr. Roberts expecting you? He asked.
No,
I said. It's a surprise visit. He looked at his watch, and I looked at mine. It was just past 10 o'clock.
Well, it might be a bit early for Mr. Roberts, he said. I heard he was partying rather late last evening, but I'll try and call him. What name shall I say?
Smith, I said. John Smith. The porter looked at me somewhat sceptically.
I get that reaction all the time, I said. Unimaginative parents.
He nodded as if making up his mind, and then disappeared into the porter's lodge. I waited patiently under the arch. Presently the porter reappeared.
Mr. Roberts asks if you could come back later, around 1 o'clock.
Could you please call Mr. Roberts again and tell him I'm from the Balscott Lighting Factory and I need to see him now? Benjamin Roberts appeared in 3 minutes flat with his long dark hair still unbrushed, bags under his eyes, and with no socks beneath his black leather shoes. He was tall, probably near 6'4" or 5", and he towered over me at just 5'8".
Mr. Smith, he asked.
I nodded.
Jarvis here tells me you're from the Balscott factory.
We were still standing in the entrance archway with students passing us continually in both directions and with Jarvis, the porter, hovering nearby.
Is there anywhere quiet we could go and talk? I asked. He turned to the porter. Thank you, Jarvis. I'll be taking Mr. Smith up to the dining hall for a while.
All visitors have to be signed in, Jarvis said rather officiously.
Benjamin Roberts went into the lodge for a moment and then reappeared.
Bloody rules, he said. They treat us like kids.
We walked along a gravel path down the side of a building and then up some wide steps to the college dining hall, an impressively tall space with 3 lines of refectory tables and benches running along its full length. Some catering staff at the far end of the hall were laying up for lunch, but Benjamin and I sat down close to the door, across one of the tables from each other.
Now, he said, what's all this about?
Benjamin, I said, starting.
Ben,
he interrupted. Sorry, Ben, I said, corrected. I was a friend of your Uncle Jolyon. He looked down at his hands on the table.
Such a shame, he said.
Uncle Jolyon was fun. I'll miss him. He looked up again at me.
But what have you to do with the factory?
Your Uncle Jolyon told me that you'd recently been to Bulgaria.
Yes, he said slowly. A group of us from the university skiing club went to Borovets during the Easter vac.
It was very good value and great snow. You should try it.
Not with my neck, I thought.
But your uncle also said you went to see the factory.
There isn't any factory, is there? He said.
You tell me, I said. You're the one that went to see it. He didn't answer, but sat looking at me across the table.
Who are you? He said. Is Smith your real name?
No, I admitted. It is not.
So who are you? He asked, standing up and with a degree of menace in his voice. And what are you after?
I'm not after anything, I said defensively, looking up at him, except to be left alone.
Then why are you here? If you want to be left alone, why don't you just go away?
I would, but someone is trying to kill me, I said, this time without looking up at his face. It was hurting my neck.
Now, will you please sit down?
He slowly lowered his huge frame back down onto the bench.
Who is trying to kill you? He asked in a tone that indicated disbelief. And why?
I don't know who, I said. Not yet, but I think I may know why.
Your uncle approached me because he was worried that the family investment in the Bulgarian factory project was a scam. He had been shown photographs of the factory buildings, but you had then told him that they didn't actually exist, so he asked me to look into it, to check that, in his words, it wasn't a rotten egg of an investment.
He smiled at the use of the words. They were clearly familiar to him.
And, I went on, I think that it is, indeed, a rotten egg of an investment. Your family money was the key to everything, because the private finance for the factory triggered the public funding for all the houses. Someone has been defrauding the European Union out of 100 million euros by obtaining grants towards the cost of building a light bulb factory and hundreds of homes that don't actually exist and never will. And that same someone is trying to kill me before I can prove it, and before I find out who they are.
I paused, and Ben Roberts sat staring at me in silence.
And, I said, going on, I believe your uncle may have been murdered for the same reason.
Chapter 16.
Uncle Jolyon wasn't murdered. He died of a heart attack, Ben Roberts said unequivocally. At least he had a heart attack and then he drowned.
Ben looked down again at the table in front of him. Jolyon Roberts had died only 4 days previously. It was still very recent, very raw.
Did you know that he was drunk when he drowned? I asked.
He couldn't have been, Ben said, looking up at me.
The post-mortem showed he was.
But that's impossible.
Why? Because he didn't drink?
Never, Ben said. He might have a tiny sip of champagne occasionally, you know, at a wedding for a toast, that sort of thing, but otherwise he never touched any alcohol.
Did he ever drink whiskey? I asked. Late at night, maybe?
Not that I was aware of, Ben said, and I very much doubt it. I tried to get him to have a beer at my 21st birthday party, but I had no chance. He said that he didn't like booze, so it was no hardship not to have it.
Was he teetotal because of his heart condition? I asked.
Heart condition? Ben said. Whatever gave you the impression Uncle Jay had a heart condition? His heart was as strong as an ox. Or at least we all thought it was until last Monday.
Perhaps Ben hadn't known about his uncle's heart condition, I thought. After all, it's not the sort of thing people usually advertise about themselves.
Tell me about your trip to Bulgaria, I said, when you went to see the factory.
There's absolutely nothing there, he said. Nothing at all. And the locals know nothing about it. They've never even heard of any plans to build a factory, let alone the houses.
Are you sure you're in the right place? I asked.
He glanced at me with a look that could only be described as one of contempt.
Of course I'm sure, he said. I took all the details with me so that I would be able to find it. My family are so proud of what the Trust does to help those less fortunate than ourselves. That's why I was so keen for the skiing club to go to Bulgaria in the first place, and especially to Borovets. It was close enough so I could spend a day going to see the factory if I wanted.
Did anyone know you were going to the factory? I asked.
No, he said. I wasn't absolutely sure that I would. It depended on the snow and the weather. To be honest,
I'd much rather ski than visit factories, but on one day the cloud was right down on the slope, so I went.
But the factory wasn't there.
Where was it meant to be? I asked.
Close to a village called Gorny, south of Sofia. But when I saw the site, it was nothing more than a toxic waste dump left over from the mass industrialization of the country during the Soviet era.
So, what have you done about it? I asked. Your family has invested a lot of money into the project.
Yeah, and lost it all, too. He sounded resigned to the loss.
Aren't you even going to try to get it back?
I don't expect so, Ben said. My father is worried that the family name will be discredited.
What he means is that we will be shown up to have been bloody fools, and fools that were easily separated from their money. He is furious about it, but mostly because he was talked into it by Uncle Jolyon and some financial advisor chap.
Gregory Black? I asked.
He's the one, he said.
So your father says to forget it? Forget £5 million? Just like that?
It's only money, he said almost flippantly. And money is fairly easy to replace. It's not like one's family reputation. It can take many generations to repair damage to one's family's standing, and sometimes it can never be restored.
It sounded to me that he was quoting his father.
But it's not possible to replace your Uncle Jolyon, I said.
That's surely all the more reason to forget about the whole thing. If the stress of this factory business gave Uncle Jay his heart attack, then we should unquestionably let sleeping dogs lie. Otherwise, our foolishness will be shown to have cost the family far more than mere money.
But I believe your uncle was murdered, I said.
Don't you want justice?
Would that bring him back? He said angrily. No, of course it wouldn't. And anyway, I believe that you are wrong. In fact, I believe you are just here to cause my family trouble.
He stood up quickly, bunching his fists.
What is it you're really after? Do you want money? Is that it? Money, or you'll go to the papers?
This could get very nasty, and very quickly, I thought. I didn't move, but just sat still on the bench, not even looking up at him.
I don't want your money, I said calmly. But what did I want? Did I really care if some clever Eurocrat in Brussels and a Bulgarian property entrepreneur were conspiring to steal €100 million from the European Union, with or without the help of Gregory Black? Or did I care that the Roberts Family Trust had been duped out of £5 million? No, I decided. I didn't care about either of those things. And was I really bothered whether Jolyon Roberts had died of natural causes or if he'd been murdered? No, I suppose I didn't even care about that. He had been a nice enough man, and I was sorry he was dead, but it didn't make any real difference to me how he died. But I did care that someone had killed Herb Kovac, and I cared very much more that they were trying to kill me, too.
So what exactly do you want? Ben Roberts asked belligerently, from somewhere above my eyeline.
I want what is right, I said, whatever that meant. And, I thought, I want to live a long and happy life with my future wife. I looked up at his face.
What is it that you want? I asked back.
He didn't answer, and I went on looking at him.
Your uncle told me you wanted to change the world.
He laughed. Uncle Jay was always saying that.
And is it true? I asked.
He thought for a moment.
It's true that I want to be a politician, he said. And all politicians hope to be in power, to be in a position to make the changes they believe in, otherwise there'd be no point.
He paused.
So, yes, I suppose I do want to change the world, and for the better.
For the better as you see it, I said.
Obviously.
So I said, is it for the better that you value your family's reputation ahead of doing what is right by your late uncle?
He sat down again and stared at me.
What's your real name? He asked.
Foxton, I said. Nicholas Foxton. I am a financial advisor with Lyle and Black, the same firm where Gregory Black works.
Well, Mr. Nicholas Foxton, financial advisor, what is it that you really want? He asked. And why have you come here?
I need to find out more about your family's investment in the Bulgarian project, I said. I simply don't have enough information to take my concerns to the authorities. They'd probably laugh at me. All I have are some copies of the original transaction report, some emails between someone in Brussels and a man in Bulgaria, and a sackful of suspicion. And now that your uncle is dead, I can't ask him.
So why don't you go and ask Gregory Black? He said.
because I'm not altogether sure that I trust him. In fact, I was sure I didn't.
Okay, I'll speak to my father about it, Ben said. But I can tell you now he won't like it, and he probably won't talk to you.
Ask him anyway, I said.
How do I contact you? He asked.
Leave a message on my mobile.
I gave him the number, which he stored on his own phone.
Please, speak to him soon.
I'm going home tonight for the weekend, Ben said. I'll try to find the right moment to speak to him on Sunday afternoon. He's always at his most relaxed after a good Sunday lunch.
I hoped it would be soon enough.
When I returned to Jan's place in Lambourne at 4:30, I found her, Claudia, and my mother sitting round the kitchen table, and they were already hard at the vino.
Bit early, isn't it? I said, looking at my watch and declining the offered glass of Chardonnay.
Early, Claudia said with a giggle. We started at lunchtime.
The others giggled with her.
Are you sure it's wise to drink so soon after surgery? I asked. Especially on top of your painkillers.
Don't be such a killjoy, Jan said amid more sniggering.
What a fine state of affairs, I thought. I was trying to keep us alive, and my mother and fiancé were drunk.
So what have you done today, other than drinking? I asked.
Nothing, Jan said. We've been talking, that's all.
I thought you'd be at the races, I said to her.
No runners today, she said. But I've got to go now to evening stables.
She stood up with a slight wobble and giggled again.
Oops, I think I've had a bit too much.
A lot too much, I thought. But what the hell, it was Friday afternoon, and it had been quite a week. I left them refilling their glasses and went upstairs to fetch my computer. I then used Jan's broadband to connect to the internet and checked my emails. As always, there were the usual collection from fund managers, but nestling amongst them was one from Patrick Lyle. It was timed at 3:50 p.m. He had clearly become fed up waiting for me to return his call, telling him where to send the letter. I could almost feel the anger as I read it.
Nicholas, he had written, as you have obviously decided not to reply to my telephone call asking for your whereabouts, I have no option but to deliver the attached letter to you by email. I find the whole situation most unsatisfactory. I hope that you soon come to your senses and start giving the firm the priority it deserves. Patrick. I clicked on the attachment. It was a letter from the lawyer, Andrew Meller, acting on behalf of Lyle and Black. There were no niceties, and the letter was very much to the point.
Mr. Foxton, in accordance with the Employment Act 2008, I'm writing to inform you that your employer, Lyle and Black and Co. Limited, hereby give notice that they consider your recent behaviour to be far below the standard expected from an employee in your position. Consequently, Lyle and Black and Co. Limited hereby issue you with a formal warning as to your future conduct. Furthermore, and in keeping with the statutory requirements as laid down in the Act, you are requested and required to attend a disciplinary meeting with Patrick Lyle and Gregory Black at the company offices in Lombard Street, London, at 9 o'clock on the Monday morning following the date of this letter. Yours sincerely, Andrew Meller, LLB.
It sounded to me that this time I really was about to be fired. Strangely, I didn't seem to care anymore. Perhaps that policeman at Aintree had been right all along. Becoming a financial advisor had been a bit of a come-down from the thrill of being a jump jockey. Maybe it was time for me to look for more excitement in my life. Like being shot at? Or stabbed? I think not. I'd had enough of that.
On Saturday morning, I left the three women nursing their hangovers while I went to visit Billy Searle in the Great Western Hospital in Swindon.
"So who knocked you off your bike?" I asked him. "Don't you bloody start," he said. "The fuzz have been asking me nothing else but that since I woke up."
"So why don't you tell them?" I said. "Are you effing stupid or something?" he said. "I'd rather go on living, thank you very much."
"So it wasn't an accident?" I said.
"I didn't say that. It might have been."
"Now who's been effing stupid?" I said. He stuck two fingers up at me and said nothing.
We were in a single room hidden away at the far end of one of the wards. It had taken me three separate requests to find him, as well as a security escort that had only departed after Billy had vouched for me as his friend, not foe.
"How much longer are you going to be here?" I asked him. He clearly wasn't going anywhere soon, as he was firmly attached to the bed by a weights contraption that was pulling on his right leg.
"About another week," he said. "At least that's what they tell me. They need to apply something called a fixator to my leg, but they can't do that until the traction has pulled everything straight. Then I'll be able to get up."
"I thought they pinned and plated broken legs these days."
"I did too," he said. "But the doc here said that this is the best way, and it was I to argue."
He grinned.
Both he and I knew that Billy Searle argued all the time. Anyway, I was effing unconscious at the time.
I thought you were going to die, I said.
No bloody chance, he replied, still grinning.
And I was arrested for your attempted murder.
Yeah, he said, so I heard, serves you right.
What for, I said.
He laughed. For being such a boring bastard.
Was I really boring?
I'm sorry. You were more fun as a jock, Billy said.
Do you remember that time we all got thrown out of that effing hotel in Torquay after your big win at Newton Abbot?
I smiled. I remembered it well.
It was all your fault, I said. You poured champagne into their grand piano.
Yeah, well, so maybe I did, he said. But it was a crap piano anyway, and it was you throwing those pot plants around that did for us in the end.
It was true, I thought. The plants had come out of their pots and the earth had spread all over the new carpet. The hotel manager had not been at all pleased. We had been politely asked to leave and never to come back, or else he would call the police. Billy and I laughed together at the memory.
Those were the days, he said. Carefree and bloody stupid we were. But such fun, I said, still laughing.
For both of us, it seemed, fun had been on the wane recently.
So who do you owe $100,000 to, I asked.
The laughter died in Billy's throat, but he didn't answer.
Was it the same guy who tried to kill you?
He still didn't answer, he just looked at me.
Or was he just trying to give you a gentle reminder to pay up, a reminder that went too far? Did the bloody cops tell you to ask me that? He said crossly.
No, of course not, I said. They don't even know I'm here.
So why are you so bloody interested in me all of a sudden?
The bonhomie of just a couple of minutes previously had disappeared completely. Billy, I'm just trying to help you, I said.
I don't need your fucking help,
he said explosively, just as he'd done outside the weighing room at Cheltenham. That's what you said to me once before, and you ended up in here. Next time it might be the morgue. He lay back against the hospital pillows and said nothing.
All right, I said. If you won't tell me who, at least tell me why you owe someone $100,000. Then I can properly advise you about your financial dealings. I can't, he said, staring at the ceiling. Even if I didn't end up dead, which I probably would, I'd have no bloody job left.
Against the rules of racing, I quoted somewhat self-righteously. He turned his head and gave me a sideways look.
Actually, no. At least not that time. That's what's so bloody ironic.
He paused.
What's ironic? I prompted. Are you sure you're not working for the fuzz?
I swear on a bottle of champagne and a grand piano, I said, with a smile.
And some separated effing pot plants, he asked,
smiling also.
Them too, I said, placing my right hand over my heart. He thought for a while longer, as if still debating whether or not to tell me. I won a race I should have lost, he said finally.
What do you mean, a race you should have lost?
I told him I'd lose, but then I went and bloody won it, he said.
That was rather careless of you.
No, not really, he said. I did it on purpose. I was so fed up with that bastard Vickers overtaking me in the championship, I was trying to win on everything I rode. Fat lot of good it did me. I've come bloody second yet again.
So who was it that you told you'd lose the race? He thought for a moment.
Sorry, mate, he said. I can't tell you that. My effing life would be worth tuppence.
Is he a bookie? I asked.
Nope, he said with certainty. He's a bloody knob.
I expect to Billy, anyone who spoke the Queen's English without a liberal scattering of swear words would be classed as a knob.
Which knob in particular? I asked. I'm not saying, he said, but even if I did, you wouldn't effing believe it.
And does this knob still want his 100,000?
I expect so, he said. That's what he claims he lost because I won the race. But I haven't actually talked to him since this little caper. Perhaps I'll tell him to bugger off. A broken leg must be worth $100,000 at least.
Tell him you'll enlighten the cops as to the identity of your attacker if he doesn't leave you alone.
Don't be bloody naive, he said. These sort of guys don't mess about. Telling him that would get me killed for sure.
Sounds to me like you're in trouble if you do say who attacked you, and also if you don't.
You are so right, he said. Once you say yes to them the first time, you're bloody hooked for life. They've got you by the balls, and there's no way out.
He leaned his head back against the white pillows, and I thought there were tears in his eyes.
Billy, I said, there will never be a way out unless you fight back. Well, count me out, he said adamantly without moving. I'm not going to be the first over the top to be shot down. I value my jockey's license.
So, how often have you stopped one? I asked.
Too bloody often, he said.
I was surprised. Billy didn't have a reputation as being a fixer.
About 10 times altogether, I suppose, he said.
spread over the past 3 years or so, but I decided there would be no more when Frank Miller broke his leg in December and I finally had the chance to be champion jockey. But then young Mark Vickers pops up to beat you.
The bastard, he said with feeling. It's not bloody fair.
Life wasn't fair, I thought. Ask anyone with cancer. Jan Setter had already left for Uttoxeter races by the time I arrived back at her house at noon. I would have loved to have gone with her, but I was worried that my enemies might have seen us together and worked out where I was staying. Claudia was beginning to think I was becoming paranoid, but I would rather be paranoid than dead, and I only had to mention the dead gunman for her to agree to almost anything.
"But how much longer do we need to stay here?" she asked. "I want to go home."
"I do too, my darling," I said. "We will go home just as soon as it is safe." I had asked Jan over breakfast how much longer we could stay. "How long do you need?" she'd asked. "I don't know, another few days at least." "I'll need you out by next Friday at the latest," she said. "I've got my sister and her family coming for the weekend." By next Friday, we would have been here for 8 nights. "I sincerely hope it won't be as long as that," I'd said. But in truth, I had no real idea when it might be safe to go home. "That's a shame," Jan had said. "I'm quite enjoying the company. I get so bored here on my own since my divorce." I logged onto the internet and checked my emails. There were none. It had to be the weekend. With the exception of dealings on foreign markets, which could extend the working week for a few hours at either end, all financial services in the UK usually went to sleep at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and awoke again at 8 on Monday morning, as if the weekend had never been. Except, of course, for interest, which was charged daily on loans, whatever day of the week it was. I used online banking to check on my personal accounts. Things might be going to get quite tight if I did lose my job at Lyle & Black. I had managed to save quite well over the previous 5 years, but much of it had been used to pay off the debts that I'd run up as a student. While I might regularly handle investments for others of hundreds of thousands or even millions of pounds, my own nest egg was much more modest. Historically, the stock market has always outperformed fixed interest investments such as bank accounts, certificates of deposit, and government bonds. However, stock markets are very susceptible to even minor changes in investor confidence and can fluctuate quite dramatically, especially downwards. For long-term investments, say over 10 or 20 years or more, the stock market is considered to be the best, but if you need your money out sooner, the risk that the market may go down suddenly just before you need it would be too great, and much lower risk assets may be better. Consequently, as an investor gets older and the time for buying a pension becomes nearer, the balance tends to move away from high-risk stocks and further towards the safer bonds. In my case, with my expected pension requirements still a long way over the horizon, my savings were almost totally in equities. I would ride the stock market roller coaster, but hope and expect the underlying trend to be upwards. If I did get fired from my job, I might need to live off my savings for a while, and then what would I do? Billy had accused me of being boring, but it wasn't me that was boring. I decided it was my job. I needed more excitement in my life, more adrenaline rushing through my veins, but not necessarily due to having a silenced pistol pointed at me. But what could I do? I was trained and qualified only to be a financial advisor, but what I wanted to be most was a jockey or a rodeo rider or a free-fall skydiving instructor or a crocodile fighter or... Bugger my dodgy neck. My mother interrupted my depressing thoughts by asking me what I wanted for lunch.
"What do we got?"
I asked. "Jan said we can use whatever we want from the fridge or from the larder."
"So what is there?" I said.
"Come and have a look."
In truth, there wasn't very much to choose from. Just a few low-calorie frozen meals for one in the freezer, with more bare shelves than anything in the larder. Old Mother Hubbard would have felt quite at home. "Time to go shopping," I said.
So the three of us piled into the unremarkable blue hire car and went to a huge supermarket on the outskirts of Newbury in order to fill the empty spaces in Jan's fridge and larder. It was the least we could do as uninvited guests. While Claudia and my mother went from aisle to aisle, loading two large trolleys with mountains of food, I was banished by them to the clothing section. I browsed through the rails of shirts and trousers, jackets and suits. But sadly, this particular supermarket didn't stock bulletproof vests.
Chapter 17. Sunday was, indeed, A day of rest. The trip to the supermarket had almost been too much for Claudia, who was still far from well after her surgery.
Don't try and do too much too soon, Mr. Tomic, the surgeon, had said. Plenty of rest is needed to allow the abdominal wall to mend.
He hadn't mentioned anything about running upstairs, shouting at gunmen or food shopping, but he probably wouldn't have approved of any of them.
You stay in bed today, I said to Claudia. I'll fetch you some breakfast.
She smiled and closed her eyes again as I went out. Jan was already downstairs making toast. My God, she said, going into the larder. We've even got marmalade. She turned round and grinned at me. I can't remember when I last had so much food in here. I'm completely useless at cooking. All I can do is heat things up in the microwave, but you really shouldn't have bought so much.
Consider it our rent, I said.
You don't have to pay rent, lover boy, she said, coming back out of the larder and opening the marmalade.
You can pay me in kind, she laughed,
except I now know I have no chance of that.
I'm sorry, I said. Don't be, she said. I think Claudia is really lovely. You're a lucky man.
She paused and breathed deeply.
And I suppose I'd better stop calling you lover boy.
There were tears in her eyes. I went over to her and gave her a hug. There was nothing to say, so I didn't speak. I just held her tightly until the moment had passed. Life can be so random, she said, stepping back from me. When I was married to Stuart, all I wanted was to divorce him and keep half his fortune. Well, I've done that, but... And I know this sounds crazy. I miss him. I even miss the god-awful rows we used to have. Now, with Maria away at university in London, I'm just a rich, lonely old spinster.
But you must have masses of friends, I said.
She looked at me as she spread the marmalade on her toast.
I have plenty of acquaintances, but no real friends. Racing is so competitive that I find it difficult to make any true friends with racing people. Of course, I know lots of them round here, other trainers and such, and I see them at the races. But I'm not a member of the village dinner party set. All my friends were Stuart's friends, and when he went, they went too.
Well, it's high time you met some more, I said, trying to lighten the mood. She laughed again, but only briefly.
That's not as simple as it sounds. And finding someone to satisfy one's needs is far from straightforward, I can tell you. You chaps have it made.
In what way, I asked.
If a man wants sex, he can just go and buy it from some girl on a street corner, or in some lap dancing club, she said. It's not so easy for a middle-aged woman.
I stood there slightly dumbstruck. I had always treated her advances as a bit of a joke. I hadn't realized the degree of her desperation.
Oh, Jan, I said. I'm so sorry.
I don't want your pity, she said, quickly turning away from me and taking the marmalade back into the larder.
No, I thought. She wanted my body.
I took a cup of coffee and some muesli up to Claudia.
You took your time, she said, sitting up in bed.
Sorry, I was talking to Jan.
Isn't she lovely, Claudia said. We had a long chat yesterday morning while you were out.
What did you talk about, I asked.
Life in general, she said obliquely. Stuff like that.
Did you tell her about, you know?
Why was the word cancer so difficult to use? I started to, but then your mother came in, and I'm still not sure it's time to tell her yet.
But when will it be time, I said. Now seems as good a time as any.
I suppose you're right, she said. I just feel...
She stopped.
What? I said. I suppose I feel a failure. And I don't want her to be disappointed in me.
Don't be daft, I said. She loves you,
only because she thinks I'm her pathway to grandchildren.
That's not true, I said. But I did wonder if she was right.
And she won't love me if I marry you and then we find I can't have any babies. She will then see me not as a pathway, but as an obstacle. She was almost in tears.
Darling, I said, please don't upset yourself, okay? If you don't want to, we won't tell her. Not yet. But we would have to tell her, if and when... Claudia's hair started falling out. The rest of Sunday seemed to drag on interminably, with me forever wondering how Ben Roberts was faring with his father. But as I was still reluctant to leave my mobile phone switched on, I would have no way of knowing anyway. My mother, with Jan helping, cooked roast beef for lunch with all the trimmings, the wonderful smells even enticing Claudia downstairs in her dressing gown.
I can't tell you how long it's been since I had a proper Sunday lunch in this house, Jan said as we all sat down at the kitchen table.
Not since Stuart left, that's for sure. He used to do the cooking, she laughed. Can't you stay forever? The lunch was accompanied by a couple of bottles of the supermarket's finest claret, of which I had just one small glass. Someone had to keep their wits about them. I left the ladies to sleep it off on the deep sofas in the drawing room while I again went to make some calls from Jan's office. First, I used her landline to remotely access my voicemail. There were four new messages. All were from Chief Inspector Flight, and each one threatened me with arrest if I didn't come forward immediately to speak to him. He read out a number where he could always be reached, and I wrote it down on the notepad beside the telephone. But there was no message from Ben Roberts. Perhaps he hadn't yet found the right moment to speak to his father. Next, I called DCI Tomlinson's mobile, taking care to dial 141 first to withhold Jan's number from caller ID. He answered at the fourth ring, but he sounded as if I'd woken him from a Sunday afternoon slumber. Sorry, I said, I thought you'd have your phone off if you weren't working.
I am working, he said. I'm in my office just having 40 winks on my desk. I was up half the night.
Partying? I asked.
Something like that, he said. Or what goes for partying round these parts? An abused girlfriend finally had too much and stabbed her boyfriend to death.
Nice.
No, he said, not really. She stabbed him about 30 times with a screwdriver. He bled to death. It was not a pretty sight, and especially not at 4 in the morning when I should have been tucked up in my bed. Sorry, I said. Thanks, he replied, but it's sadly too common round here, especially after they've been drinking. I rarely get a full night's sleep on a Saturday.
I decided against adding homicide detective to my list of possible future careers. Do you have any news for me? I asked.
What sort of news? He asked back.
Anything, I said. How about the dead man? Was he Bulgarian?
We don't know yet. His image and fingerprints haven't turned up on anything. Still waiting for the DNA analysis, but I can tell you one thing.
Yes, I said eagerly.
The forensic boys have been working overtime, and they tell me the gun matches.
Matches what? I asked.
The gun found in the bush outside your mother's cottage was definitely the same gun that killed Herb Kovac, and they're pretty sure the same gun was also used to shoot at you in Finchley. They can't be 100% certain without the bullets.
The image of the line of policemen crawling up Litchfield Grove on their hands and knees came into my mind. They obviously hadn't found anything.
Does that mean that Chief Inspector Flight is now off my back?
I wouldn't exactly say that, he said. He's still up in mad.
Yes, I said, I know. He's left messages on my phone.
Speak to him, Tomlinson said. That's probably all he wants. He may think you're playing with him.
Does he still want to arrest me? I asked.
I don't know. Ask him.
We disconnected. I looked at the number on the notepad and thought about calling DCI Flight.
Ignoring him would only make him madder, and then he might use more of his energies trying to find me than discovering the identity of his corpse.
But I wasn't going to call him from here.
Dialing 141 might be enough to prevent the number appearing on caller ID, but I was sure the police could still obtain it from the telephone company if they really wanted to.
But I called Chief Inspector Tomlinson using Jan's phone. What was the difference? It was a matter of trust, I thought. I trusted Chief Inspector Tomlinson not to go to the trouble of finding where I was from the call, but I didn't trust DCI Flight. So at about 5 o'clock, I drove into the outskirts of Swindon and stopped in a pub car park before switching on my mobile and calling the Gloucestershire detective.
DCI Flight, he said crisply, answering at the first ring.
This is Nicholas Foxton, I said.
Ah, he said, and about time too.
Have you spoken to DCI Tomlinson and Superintendent Yearing? I asked.
Yes, he said slowly. I have.
Good, I said. So who was the man at my mother's cottage?
Mr. Foxton, he replied curtly. It is me who needs to ask you some questions, not the other way round.
Ask away, I said. What happened at your mother's cottage last Thursday evening?
A man with a gun broke in, we had a fight, and he fell down the stairs and broke his neck.
Is that all?
He asked.
Isn't that enough? I asked sarcastically.
Oh, yes, and he was trying to stab me at the time he fell down the stairs.
We found a knife under the body, he said. But why did he need one? What happened to his gun?
It was under the fridge, I said. He paused.
And how did it get under the fridge?
I hit it with an umbrella.
This time, there was a lengthy pause from the other end.
Are you being serious, Mr. Foxton? He asked.
Very, I said.
The man cut the power and the telephone. He then broke a pane of glass in the kitchen to get in, and as he was climbing through the window, I hit him with a golf umbrella. He dropped the gun, which slid under the fridge. He then took a knife from the block and tried to stab me. I managed to get upstairs, but the man followed. As he was attacking me, we struggled, and both of us fell down the stairs. He came off worse. End of story. There was another pause. Another lengthy pause. Almost as if the chief inspector had not been listening to me. "Hold on," I said suddenly. "I'll call you back." I hung up, switched my phone off, and quickly drove the car out of the pub car park and down the road towards the city centre. After about half a mile, a police car with blue flashing lights drove past me, going fast in the opposite direction. Now, was that just a coincidence, I wondered? I went right round a roundabout and drove back to the pub, but I didn't go in. I drove straight past without even slowing down. The police car, still with its blue flashes on, had stopped, so that it was completely blocking the pub car park entrance, and two uniformed policemen were getting out of it. Was that also a coincidence? No, I decided, it was not. Obviously, I hadn't needed to ask DCI Flight if he still wanted to arrest me. I'd just seen the answer. I drove north along the A419 dual carriageway towards Cirencester, in the opposite direction to Lambourne, and pulled over near the village of Cricklade. I turned my phone on again and pressed redial. DCI Flight answered immediately. "Trust," I said. "That's what you need." "Give yourself up," he said. "But I've done nothing wrong. Then you have nothing to fear." I hung up and switched off my phone. Then I started the car and made my way back to Lambourne, being careful not to speed or in any way attract the attention of any passing policeman. Damn it, I thought.